tribe has been passed down by the Lakota for generations and holds infinite stories. The tragedy at Wounded Knee is only one imprint. Your mind went to the most violent one, and the last. But this pipe has celebrated the sacredness of every day and every life on Earth for hundreds of years. It holds the Lakota's history and is much too important to stay lost. He held it out to her, explaining its design. The four ribbons represent the four corners of the universe. The eagle feather tells us the four are truly one. One spirit, the Great Spirit. And our thoughts should soar higher than an eagle. And these 12 feathers, he said, as he moved his hand across the line of dangling feathers underneath, creating a rippling effect, are the cycles of the 12 moons. He looked down at the pipe. Melisandre could tell he'd seen every memory it held. Then he said something in Lakota. Goosebumps rose on her arms. He had spoken the words that were embedded in the pipe. "What does that mean?" she whispered.
"Only the hands of the good shall take care of it, and the bad shall never see it."
Rowan sat the pipe gently back down on the table. For a moment, she couldn't say anything. The weight of the room was pressing on her. She wanted to leave, but couldn't, trying to understand. She turned to him.
"So you've been finding these lost heirlooms of the Lakota?"
"I work in groups. Periods of time in history, geographical location. There are other collections at the warehouse. Holly's focusing on returning these right now, so we moved the Lakota artifacts over here."
He led her out of the room and closed the door. Melisandre frowned, realizing.
"So this is the Heirloom Foundation? The nonprofit organization that returns lost heirlooms to people?"
His eyebrows rose.
"You know about the foundation?"
"I looked up West Inc., and it's linked to Holly's name."
She signaled to the closed door. "So this is the other half of your business?" He nodded.
"I try to give back in small ways. I can't just make money off what I do."
A flush of shame hit her. She had never once considered using her gift to help others. Granted, she was nowhere near Rowan's level of expertise, plus he had been finding relics his whole life, but suddenly she felt embarrassed by everything, by her assumptions of him in the beginning, how she had judged him for leading a life of wealth and privilege. He was a lone psychometrist willing to face the darkness to help lost treasures find their way home. The poignancy swallowed up her heart. Rowan was unlike anyone she had ever met. After they left the back room, Rowan finished the introductions between Melisandre and Holly. Melisandre didn't know what to make of Rowan's partner. Holly Beauchene wasn't the warmest person, and Melisandre had a hard time seeing past the facade. Holly was too polished, too poised, too southern. Not a speck of makeup was out of line, not a hair out of place. A woman who used that much hairspray must have issues. What in the world did Holly and Rowan have in common? A love for antiques? Melisandre wasn't sure if she could like her, but right now she was too dazed to worry about it. Rowan whisked her and Parker back into the car. Soon they were dining at a restaurant in the French Quarter, under vaulted ceilings and slow-turning ceiling fans, and looking at the picturesque view of Royal Street from the patio doors. Thankfully, the traumatic memories from the heirlooms had begun to recede into the back of her mind. Rowan recommended they all order the restaurant's signature gumbo. Melisandre smiled vacantly during the waitress's culinary trivia talk about how, in New Orleans, the Holy Trinity is two parts onion, one part celery, one part bell pepper, and garlic is the Pope. Melisandre must have had tourist written all over her face. After the waitress left, she asked Rowan, "So, does your psychometrist friend in London help you with the foundation?" Rowan shook his head.
"Stuart and I met through my mother. We're rock climbing buddies.
Parker jumped into the conversation.
No way! That's so cool! You rock climb?
I like to boulder, Rowan said.
Wicked.
Parker was impressed.
That's where you don't use ropes, right?
Millicent looked at Rowan, wide-eyed. Isn't that dangerous? Rowan shrugged.
Uncertain a sense. But I've been doing it since I was a kid.
Where do you climb?
Parker looked utterly fascinated. Rowan was quickly becoming his new favorite person.
All over. Stuart and I meet several times a year and take turns picking the spot, trying to one-up each other on finding the hardest climb. We were supposed to meet in Texas, and he didn't show.
Millicent could see his worry. She hoped his friend was all right. We want to go to London with you.
We do?
Parker turned to her in shock. Millicent shot him a look that told him to keep quiet. I want to know what's going on with the psychometrist group. I can't just sit and wait in a hotel room.
You're not going.
Rowan shook his head. I am going, she said adamantly. Rowan leaned back in his chair, crossing his arms. Parker chimed in.
I don't want to go either.
Millicent turned to Parker in surprise. Why don't you want to go to London? Parker shrugged, looking weary.
I just want to stay at the hotel and sleep.
Millicent's heart sank. She understood why he wanted to be alone. They were both processing losing the house in their own way. But the thought of staying cooped up in a hotel room while Rowan tried to figure out who had destroyed her house was downright torturous to her. She needed to go. That Parker didn't want to was a complication. You can't stay at the hotel by yourself, she said, as the waitress came and delivered their gumbos. You have to come with me. Rowan reiterated,
You're not going.
Parker ignored him. Her brother knew her well and could tell she was dead set on going. Parker pointed out,
2 or 3 days at a hotel is nothing compared to summer camp, and I've been doing that for years. Please? I promise I'll stay put.
Millicent mulled over the idea. Parker had been doing summer camp for years and had been left alone at the house for a weekend, too. She knew he'd be okay. The unspoken question was, no running away? She searched his eyes. You promise. You're sure you'll be okay. Parker nodded.
Can I do pay-per-view while you're gone? Oh my gosh. People, you're not coming with me,
Rowan erupted. The frustration in his voice was comical.
Yes, I am. She threw back, ignoring the sound of Parker snickering into his gumbo.
You're not going, Rowan said for the 4th time. Am I talking to a wall?
Why are you being so stubborn?
Why are you?
She tried to make him see reason.
I'll just get my own plane ticket and meet you over there.
They stared at each other at an impasse. Millicent had to admit she was enjoying the argument. It was waking her back up, making her feel alive again. Their mental tug of war felt primal, like a circling dance. She spelled it out clearly for him. This is my life. I need to be in control of it. To do that, I have to find out what is going on. I need to go with you. I refuse to stay here and be babysat. By Holly, she wanted to add, but didn't. Rowan's business partner hadn't seemed too thrilled by the idea either. Rowan let out a pained sigh and ate his gumbo. Millicent watched him, noting his gloves were still on. He must never take them off. Ignoring her food, she waited for him to look up at her. She'd eat when she won the argument. The fierce determination in her stare communicated without words, I'm going, and there's no stopping me. To drive it home, she sat up straighter and flicked her hair behind her in defiance. His eyes flashed in response, and she knew she'd won.
Your gumbo's getting cold,
he said. Then he added,
and it's freezing over there. You'll need a winter coat.
Mellicent nodded, triumphant, and looked down at the decadent bowl filled with seafood, okra, and a perfect scoop of rice in the center of a thick, dark roux. She should have been ravenous, but instead her stomach was a jumble of nerves. Tomorrow, she was going to London.
21. The Doll. The next morning, Rowan sat behind the wheel of his car and watched Mellicent leave the hotel lobby with a small overnight bag. She had a bright purple winter parka in her hands and a long muffler. He was pleased to note she'd bought a pair of winter boots. She walked in front of his car, fully aware he was watching her, and flicked her hair back behind her shoulders in that alluring way of hers. Rowan mumbled to himself, "This was a bad idea." He couldn't believe he'd let her talk him into coming. She was a complete distraction. He'd never been so hyper-aware of someone before. It'd be so much simpler if she had stayed at the hotel while he focused on finding Stuart. When she got in the car, there was a moment of silence. Then he asked, "Are you sure Parker will be okay on his own?" Rowan had no problem if she wanted to change her mind about going. Then maybe he could sleep on the 9-hour flight to Heathrow. "It's only a few days, and he wants some alone time. I'm going." She stared at him, determined. Rowan's eyes traveled over her face. She looked just like she had in his favorite imprint, framed by the sunlight. His resistance was starting to melt. Right now, he wanted nothing more than to lean over and kiss her. Instead, he put the car into drive with a sigh and drove them to the airport.
"Thank you for the flowers," she said. "It was a sweet gesture, but..."
But odd is what she was getting at.
"You didn't have to."
"I wanted to." He hesitated, abashed at having to explain. "They read the room better than anything."
"What do you mean, read the room?"
"Flowers are the most sensitive imprint holders. The imprint's gone when they die, but while they're alive, they pick up everything around them."
"So you're spying on me with flowers?" she asked, with an incredulous voice.
"God, no." He choked out a laugh. "I'm not spying on you." He may have replayed the imprint of her making the snow globe countless times in his head, but that was one imprint. "I'm not planning to touch the flowers unless I have to. It's for peace of mind. What if something happened to you two at the hotel while I'm not there? How would I know or be able to find you?" She didn't respond, and he glanced over to gauge her expression. Her eyes were bright with emotion. It was the last thing he was expecting. "Jesus, Mellicent, I'm sorry."
"No," she stopped him. "It's just, thank you for caring. I haven't been able to think straight since the fire," she confessed. "I'm sorry if I overreact or jump to the wrong conclusion."
She rubbed her forehead. Rowan glanced over at her again. She looked more tired than she let on. "Have you gotten any more news about the house?"
"No."
She shook her head, and he watched a shadow fall on her face.
"I checked in with the investigators this morning. They have nothing."
Rowan's thoughts returned to the man in the hoodie. Why had he done it? How was he involved with the Uparts? He hoped London offered answers. They finished the rest of the drive to Lakefront Airport in silence. They checked in and were escorted to the plane, a Gulfstream G3 that sat 8. When they got on board, Mellicent took the second seat on the right. The configuration was a single row on each side of a center aisle. Rowan took the seat across from hers. The pilot stuck his head out of the cockpit to greet them and said they'd be taking off shortly. The galley was fully stocked, and they were welcome to help themselves. "And we have your special request," the pilot said, winking, and went back up front. Mellicent turned to Rowan with questioning eyes.
"What special request?"
Rowan went over to the little galley. "Even though we're about to fly out, you can't come to New Orleans without having Café du Monde in the morning." He poured them each a coffee and brought over a cardboard box. Inside were decadent-looking pastry puffs, shaped like squares and liberally dusted with powdered sugar. "The beignet," he said, offering her one. Mellicent looked touched by the gesture. The expression on her face made him glad he'd made the request. He watched her savor the rich chicory coffee and French donut. She put away not two but three of the squares, along with two cups of coffee. They were well in the air and at cruising altitude when she finally leaned back, done with breakfast.
"Thank you. That was so delicious."
There was a lull of comfortable silence. For a moment, their worries on the ground were at bay.
"You know, I have a question," she said.
He looked at her expectantly and waited as she tried to find the words.
"Who helped you? When I touched the pipe, you helped me come back. Who helped you when the same thing happened the first time?"
Rowan thought back to the first time an imprint had swallowed him up whole. He'd been 12. Through the years, he'd tried to block the whole experience from his mind, but when he thought on it, it still felt like yesterday. "My mom. I touched the wrong thing, and she found me." His mother had found him unconscious, unable to speak or move. She and his father rushed him to the hospital. The doctors couldn't find the cause and thought it was a seizure, but his mother knew he had touched something so horrible it had shut his body down. She searched his room until she found the object.
"What was it?" Mellicent whispered.
Rowan barely heard the question, lost in the memory. "A doll I found at a flea market. It was beaded, made of hide, from the Old West. Or so I thought." He smiled bitterly. "I'd started wearing gloves the previous year and preferred to read imprints in private, away from people. I took it home, and that night I got it out in my room." He swallowed, unsure if he could describe what had happened. He'd never tried before. "Up until then, it was more like a game to me, peering into the past like a spy through a window. I would go looking for old, unusual things at flea markets with my dad. He was always on the hunt for treasure and had grand schemes to open up a family business." "West Incorporated," she said. Rowan looked at her and gave a faint nod. "But this was different. This doll held so much despair it choked me." He shook his head, trying to brush past the worst of it. "That night I was delirious, trapped in the imprint, talking in my sleep. My mom thought it was a bad nightmare, but then I went into a coma for 3 days. I was in the hospital. My father stayed by my bedside while my mother went to the library to figure out what the doll was. She was able to trace it based on my sleep talking. She wanted to find its history so she could explain it to me and bring me back."
"What was it?"
Mellicent hesitated.
"The doll."
"The doll had belonged to a girl named Henny," he said. His voice still caught when he said her name, even after all these years. "Her mother had made it for her. Henny was a girl brought by ship to New Orleans in 1800. She was from a small village in Africa, captured by slavers and thrown on a boat with strangers for 70 days. She used to dream of dying in her sleep." His eyes met hers. "My mother spent days researching the U.S. Customs Slave Manifest historical records, trying to find her. Henny was separated from her family, sold to a plantation." Decades later, Rowan could feel the same feeling of bleakness well up inside him, threatening to take over. He could never forget Henny. He brought his hands into a soothing yoni mudra, joining his thumbs and index fingers to redirect his energy. Mellicent's eyes went to his hands in question. He held his hands up to her, keeping his fingers locked in the position. "That was the first time we tried the madras. My mother was desperate to help me expel that memory. She would sit there with me and hold my hands in the positions, with my fingers in hers, breathing with me."
"Like you did with me,"
Mellicent said, her eyes soft with understanding. She knew how it felt to be lost within a life that was not your own. "Then I came back." Rowan released his hands from the finger lock.
"Your mom sounds like an amazing woman."
Rowan gave her a half smile. That was one way of describing his mother. That doll was the beginning of the end for Rowan's parents' marriage. They separated the following year because of the incident. His parents didn't need to see a marriage counselor to figure out Rowan was the reason they could no longer stay together. They couldn't agree on what was the right course for their son and his extraordinary gift. Rowan's mother wanted him to stop peering into the past altogether, while Rowan's father thought his son had been put on this earth for a reason, and they needed to allow his ability to flourish. In the end, the solution meant living in separate houses with joint custody.
Was that what made you start the Heirloom Foundation? The doll?
Rowan looked over at her and shook his head. He didn't know how to explain Göbekli Tepe, and he didn't want to get into too many details. I was in Turkey visiting an archaeological site and touched something very old, too old, and I couldn't find my way out of the imprint. I didn't know if it was the time span, the imprint itself, or the power within the site, but it felt like drowning. Afterward, the whole experience made me reassess my life, my gift, everything. Our time here is finite, and I wanted to make mine count for something, something more than myself. It's always moved me how so many memories from generations of a family can exist in a single object. It became a passion of mine to find the lost ones. She nodded in understanding.
How do you return them? How does it work?
I trace the imprints back to the original owner. Once I have that information, Holly and I work with both a genealogist and an online investigator to track down the descendants. After they're located, Holly usually writes to them first and follows up with a phone call, saying that a lost heirloom of their family has been traced back to them. Rowan smiled. Many times they think it's a scam at first, too good to be true. But Holly has her ways. Mellicent gave him a faint smile. If it's a rare or high-value item, she flies out and hand-delivers it. Otherwise, we use a private courier and arrange a delivery time. His most recent recipient, Faye Young, was the rightful owner of a high-value heirloom that was part of the Lakota collection. Rowan had insisted on Holly hand-delivering it. Faye was the great-granddaughter of Edith Brown, a Lakota medicine woman who was the keeper of the Winter Count, her tribe's recorded history. The Winter Count was a piece of animal hide that looked like a blanket. Every winter, the tribe would capture the essence of their year in a picture and paint it on the hide. The symbol represented the whole community and their recorded history. Edith's great-grandmother had been the keeper of the Winter Count, and her tribe's hide stretched back hundreds of years. All Faye knew was that the Foundation had traced the artifact back to her family and was returning it to the rightful owner. As a proud Lakota descendant of the Sioux Nation, Faye planned to donate the Winter Count to the Sioux Indian Museum in Rapid City. Holly had sent Rowan a picture of Faye beaming to the camera as she held up the hide. When Rowan stared at Faye's picture, he could hear the echo of the Lakota's blessing. Hetchetu Welo. It is indeed a good day. The picture had filled Rowan with a deep joy that wasn't entirely his own, but also Edith Brown's. Edith's last hope before dying was that her people's record would not be lost. Returning heirlooms gives me a satisfaction that no amount of money can, he said. Heirlooms keep the stories alive. Mellicent seemed to grasp what he was saying. She was leaning forward, listening intently with her elbow on the seat rest. How did you become so good at reading things? Her question surprised him again. He wasn't used to anyone asking him about his ability. Even his mother had stopped years ago. He tried his best to explain. Growing up in New Orleans was like a wonderland, a training ground, being able to walk into any corner antique shop and pick up a bona fide piece of the past. He had held a cornet of Joe King Oliver's, Louis Armstrong's mentor, and heard the music. He'd touched the fence around Jackson Square and seen the hand of Michaela Almonester Pontalba, the Baroness of New Orleans, who conceived the cast-iron design in 1851 after returning from France, broken-hearted. He'd met Degas in his mind when the painter came to visit his cousins in 1872, and he overheard the conversation between the pirates Jean and Pierre Lafitte and Andrew Jackson at the blacksmith shop when they agreed to aid in the War of 1812 in exchange for their pardon. I saw what New Orleans was like before the city changed hands from the Spanish to the French to the Americans. I saw the settlers, the immigrants from Germany and Ireland building the channel by hand. I saw the slave rebellion. New Orleans had been named the most haunted city in the country, the place where they said the dead and the living slept side by side, with barely a wall between them. Through the imprints, Rowan had walked down the steamboat wharfs, visited the slaughterhouses, and watched the white flags from the plantations being raised on a pole beside the river to call the doctor when someone was sick. He visited the room where Étienne de Beauret discovered how to granulate sugar, an invention that would change the city forever. Even without his ability, Rowan couldn't imagine living anywhere else. The city was his domain, and he knew every inch of it, through every century. "Is that why you wear gloves? To keep control?" Rowan looked down at his hands. Most of the time, he forgot he had gloves on. They'd become like second skin. Today, he was wearing his thinnest tactical Under Armour gloves. He owned countless pairs and brands, each for different activities. These were best for working at the keyboard. "I don't want to wear gloves," she added. "I didn't suggest it." "But it helps you." Millicent considered him. "So you don't touch anything you don't want to." Rowan stared back at her, seeing the concern in her eyes, and he could tell she was wary of what challenges might exist for her further down the road if she fully exercised her power. The gloves did help him because, unlike most psychometrists, Rowan could feel every imprint from any time with excruciating detail to the point the boundaries of the years blurred. Most psychometrists were limited with the information they could retrieve from an imprint. But Rowan was a pure receiver with the rare ability to be transported into the memory. He'd stood in the past as the future's witness. There was no way he could explain some of the imprints he'd seen, or the deep marks within history, gouges left by hatred and cruelty, over beliefs, power, and greed. Rowan had witnessed tragic moments, the annihilation of life, from both world wars and the countless other conflicts that stretched further back. He'd seen how history was doomed to repeat itself until humanity acknowledged the deep connection between every living being. That was the true war, the war that never ended, and it had taken Rowan many years to learn how to live in such a world. The gloves were his armor. "You won't need gloves," he assured her, and he leaned toward her across the aisle until their faces were a breath apart. He could see the pulse at her neck speed up. He wanted to touch her. He had since he'd walked into the store in L.A. Here was a woman who shared his power, who'd begun to experience the thresholds that could be crossed. He'd never been able to have this kind of intimate conversation with anyone before, not even Stuart. He found himself wanting to share his world with Millicent and invite her in. He searched her eyes. "I only touch what I want." She met his gaze with a challenge. "Then do it." Those three words unraveled his good intentions. Their lips came together in a lock, the connection between them tightening like a twisting coil. He could easily forget everything right now, where they were going, the why, the danger. His hands came up to frame her face with surprising tenderness, and it made them both pull back in surprise. No words were needed. Now was not the right time. They made a silent agreement not to take the kiss further. "You should get some sleep," he suggested.
"Right."
Millicent nodded and leaned back in her chair. She closed her eyes, but after a moment said,
"About my snow globes, did you really only touch the one?"
"Just the one."
"But you saw a lot more than what you told me, didn't you?"
She pinned him with her eyes, knowing it was true. Then she surprised him by saying,
"I get to touch something of yours, at your house."
He laughed, not sure he was willing to concede to that demand. "I'll think about it." She shook her head and closed her eyes again.
I will. You owe me.
The retort died on his lips because he knew she was right. He had intentionally peered into her life without permission and seen things no one else knew, like a voyeur, or worse, a peeping Tom. He would be lying if he said he wished he could undo the moment, because he wasn't sorry. What he'd done was more intimate than the kiss they'd shared. The problem was he wanted more. As he watched Mellicent doze off, he pulled out his lucky coin and rolled it across his knuckles, back and forth, in a soothing motion. His thoughts strayed to Stuart. Why hadn't he called? Who was after them? The group was being targeted one by one because of their research, and Rowan needed answers. He wasn't sure what he would find at Stuart's home. He only prayed his friend was safe. London. 1 week ago. Stuart went to pay for the flowers and wondered if he was overdoing it. He bought 5 arrangements on the brink of blooming. The shop owner promised they would live a long time. He hoped so. He didn't want to have to keep shelling out for daisies. That morning at the post office, he'd paid a fortune to express mail Hanush's key to Rowan. Afterward, he passed by the flower market on his way back to his flat, just as he did every morning, only this time he went inside. Rowan had mentioned on one of their climbing trips how flowers were the best imprint holders. If it had been any other person, Stuart would have thought he was joking. But Rowan didn't joke. He was also the best psychometrist Stuart knew. Nestling the flower pots in his carrying basket, he hurried back to his place 2 blocks away. Notting Hill in the morning was always a flurry. The breeze carried an inviting scent of roasted coffee and fresh-baked bread from the bakery down Portobello Road, but Stuart didn't stop. Once he arrived home, he set the flowers in strategic positions, a pot in each room. Then he took his laptop and a rolled-up map and went to the built-in bookshelf behind the sofa. The shelf swung open when he found the secret latch, revealing a wall safe inside. The safe was a hidden gem, an architectural delight, and the place where he kept all his valuables. Right now, the safe only held his laptop and the map. He locked them inside, closed the outer cabinet, and moved the sofa closer to the bookshelf for good measure to hide the spot even more. Then he grabbed his keys and left. After he'd gone, the flowers watched the room like a silent witness, and the stillness stretched through the minutes. It wasn't until the day was done and the last sliver of sunlight had left the curtain's edge that the lock in the door jimmied and turned. Only it wasn't the sound of a key. 2 men in ski masks and black attire stepped inside, blending in with the shadows. They used high-powered pen lights to pierce the darkness as they searched the house, opening every cabinet and drawer with painstaking precision, careful not to leave a trace. The sound of the key at the front door made them kill their lights. When Stuart walked in, the larger of the 2 men grabbed him from behind and held him in an arm lock, clamping his hand over his mouth. "Where are the Upparts?" The other man shut the door behind them with an ominous click. 22. The Flowers. Rowan kept his hand on the daisies and expelled a shaky breath. He was deep in the imprint, trapped by the violence of the moment. He winced as he watched the man at the door punch Stuart in the stomach, doubling him over. Stuart struggled for breath, unable to talk.
"What is it? What happened?"
Mellicent asked, but her voice sounded muted and far away to Rowan's ears. He was trying to glean every bit of information he could from the flowers. He'd found Stuart's spare key hidden in the faux rock in the garden. When he walked into the townhome, he'd been alarmed to find all the flowers. Stuart had been afraid enough to put an arrangement in every room. He'd left them for Rowan to find. Of that, Rowan was certain. Rowan hadn't needed to touch a single flower to feel the disturbance in the air. The residue of hostility lingered like an electric charge. The flowers held the imprints in vivid detail. He closed his eyes, needing to see every second. His focus was so sharpened, the present and the past fused together, and he was standing beside Stuart in the memory. The man at the door's voice was laced with a Hindi accent.
"Where is your computer? And the artifacts?"
Stuart gasped for air.
"Not here!"
The large man squeezed Stuart's arms together behind his back and pulled him up. Stuart cried out in pain as the man punched him in the gut again.
"We don't believe you," Stuart pleaded. "I swear, I swear!"
The man at the door put a hood over Stuart's face. Stuart struggled, screaming in panic. His captor gave a swift jab to his temple, causing Stuart to crumple to the ground, unconscious. The man took out his cell phone and made a call.
"We have the package, but not the goods. Possibly New York, like you thought."
He listened.
"Yes, sir."
He hung up and turned to his friend and switched to speaking Hindi. They went back and forth in quiet voices as they waited by the blinds at the front window. The big man picked Stuart up and swung him over his shoulder. They slipped outside, disappearing into the night like two shadows that had never been there at all. Rowan opened his eyes and released his hold from the flowers to find his hand was shaking. He'd just witnessed Stuart's kidnapping. So many thoughts raced through his mind at once. Stuart had bought the flowers on the same day he express mailed the key to him. Then the men had come for him. Who had they called on the phone? They wanted Stuart's research and the Uparts, and they believed someone in New York had them.
Son.
Mellicent interrupted his train of thought.
"He bought the flowers for the same reason you did, didn't he? What did you see?"
Rowan turned to look at her, unable to speak, and shook his head, his mind in a panic. He needed to call Sun and warn her, but first, he needed to see if what Stuart had hidden was still there. He hurried to the bookcase and found the latch.
"What are you doing?"
Mellicent watched, mystified, as the bookcase swung open like a cabinet to reveal the safe. Rowan closed his eyes and thought back to the numbers Stuart had used to open it. 81-2-81. He replicated the combination and the safe's door opened. The laptop and map were still there.
"This is what the men were looking for."
"What men?"
Mellicent's eyes couldn't have been any rounder as she watched him take the laptop case and the poster tube and close the safe back up again. She had her arms crossed and her hands tucked in beside her. Rowan could tell she was afraid to touch anything. Just as well, he thought. The hostility in the room was sickening. Rowan set the laptop and map down on the table.
"I'll be right back. I want to check the bedroom. Watch the door. If it sounds like anyone is coming, don't make a noise and come get me."
Mellicent nodded, cupping her mouth with shaking hands. Rowan tried to hurry. He didn't want to risk the men coming back. But when he walked into Stuart's bedroom, he stopped in shock. The bedroom was a disaster, the bed a tumble of sheets and clothes, the nightstand littered with a collection of empty scotch bottles. Women's items filled two dressers, perfume, jewelry, hairbrushes, and makeup, all in piles like a rummage sale. Rowan had stepped inside a dervish. This wasn't an ordinary, messy bedroom. This was a psychometrist's room, chock full of memories. Rowan didn't have time to touch everything to unravel what had happened, but he could feel Stuart's pain all around him, like a time capsule filled with grief. The restaurant menu sitting on the dresser drew his eye. It wasn't a takeout menu, but an actual menu with a leather-like vinyl cover and gold embossed letters. It had no business being there. Rowan quickly performed a Kasepana mudra to release the negative energy permeating the space, so he could get an objective reading. He needed to capture the imprint quickly. When he picked up the menu, both sides of it opened like a window. Stuart was sitting in the back corner of the dimly lit Italian restaurant at a table for two, watching the rain. Rivulets ran along the glass pane and obstructed his view. Even though hard sheets were coming down outside, he'd kept their plans for the evening. A bottle of champagne sat on ice. The ring was in his pocket, and the words were memorized. After he proposed to Nima, he planned to serenade her in front of all these fine restaurant goers. He was going to sing Purple Rain by Prince, and had already tipped the waitstaff. The humiliation was worth it to watch Nima laugh and flash him that, "I can't believe you did that," look. He'd already asked Miguel to be his best man. Miguel was the one who'd introduced them 2 years ago, somehow knowing Stuart would find the archaeologist from Wales irresistible. They began dating shortly after. Stuart had been boasting to everyone, including Nima, that she was going to be his wife one day. Now he was ready to make good on that promise. He sat at the table for hours. He tried calling her, convinced she'd gotten caught up at work. He ordered dinner to go and brought the menu with him so they could play restaurant at home. He promised the manager he'd bring it back. They were regulars. The manager said of course and sent him on his way. But when Stuart got home to a cold, empty house without any lights on, he began to grow afraid. The call from the hospital came minutes later as he stood in the kitchen. Stuart couldn't grasp what he was being told. A fatal car accident in the rain, blocks from the restaurant. The voice on the other end of the line destroyed him. Stuart laid his head on the counter, and the menu became his pillow as he wept. She'd been on her way. To him. Rowan held on to the imprint. Nima. With blinding clarity, he understood Stuart's quest to unravel the Upart's mystery. Stuart was trying to make his way back to Nima, to stop that day from happening. Stuart didn't want to see the imprints of the past. He wanted to go back to the past, for her. Somewhere along the way, he'd gotten tangled up with the wrong people, who were now trying to stop him instead. Rowan took out his cell phone, pacing the room as he made a call to Sun. He needed to warn her about the men coming to New York and tell her what had happened to Stuart. Mellicent's safety in London was in question, too. The men who'd taken Stuart had to be connected to the person who'd set fire to her house. He should never have brought her here and exposed her like this in the open. It had been a stupid and irresponsible thing for him to do. Stuart's abductors could even be watching the house right now. Mellicent should have stayed in New Orleans with her brother. He needed to extricate her from this nightmare. The call to Sun went straight to voicemail. He expelled a frustrated breath. "Sun, you need to get out of New York." He hesitated, not willing to say anything more in case someone else listened to the message. He added, "I'm keeping the fans safe until I can return it." He hung up and looked around the bedroom, a helpless feeling overtaking him. His friend was out there somewhere in desperate need. Rowan couldn't go to the police. No one would believe him. His best course was to dig into Stuart's research and leverage what he found. He also had one of the Uparts as collateral. The men had been looking for Hanush's key and Descartes' ring. Rowan had the key, and Guillen had the ring. Guillen could well be the person behind all of this. The men who'd taken Stuart had been speaking Hindi. Rowan turned to find Mellicent in the doorway. She was surveying the room, taking in the disarray. "Let's go." He took her hand in his without thinking. The touch of her palm hit him like a jolt, and his fingers wrapped around hers. Adrenaline coursed through him as he led her to the living room. "When we go outside, stay hidden behind me. If I tell you to run, run. Don't wait. Get in the first cab that you can, and we'll meet at Paddington Station." Mellicent nodded, trying to stay calm. He dropped her hand and put his gloves back on. Then he grabbed the laptop and map and led her out the door and locked it, all the while scanning the street. Right now, he needed to get her somewhere safe, somewhere out of London where he could study the laptop and the map while he figured out his next step in finding Stuart. There was only one place he could think to go. He just hadn't intended for Mellicent to have to meet his mother on this trip. Jocelyn Mathis wasn't the easiest person to handle, and she would have a million questions for them both. Questions he wasn't willing to answer.
23. The picture frame. They took a taxi from Notting Hill.
Mellicent knew Rowan had seen something distressing while touching the flowers at Stewart's. That much was obvious. Now she was kicking herself for not touching the flowers, too. She had come to London for answers, but she had frozen when she stepped inside the house. When she tried to ask Rowan what he had seen, he became evasive. He was brooding and staring out the cab window. "Where are we going?" she finally broke the silence.
"Oxford."
"Oxford University, Oxford?" He looked over to her.
"My mother's a professor there. We'll stay the night with her."
"Oh." Mellicent silently gulped. They were on their way to meet Rowan's mother? She remembered coming across the name of an Oxford professor in her initial online snooping, Dr. Jocelyn Mathis, who was on the Heirloom Foundation's board of directors. She was also a distinguished historian. Mellicent never imagined the woman might be his mother. Dr. Mathis either must have kept her maiden name or changed it after the divorce. The idea of meeting her made Mellicent's stomach flutter with nerves. The scene at Stewart's had been unsettling enough. Now she was about to meet the mother of her potential boyfriend. If they survived this. Mellicent wanted to ask who the men were that wanted Stewart's laptop, but she didn't want to get into it in front of the cab driver. Plus, she was pretty sure Rowan would sidestep the question. The man was forming the habit of trying to protect her. She sighed and looked out the cab window, unable to marvel at the fact she was in a taxi in London, a city she'd always wanted to visit, with a man she'd love to get to know under normal circumstances. But nothing was normal anymore. Her previous life was gone, and she still wasn't ready to revisit that pain or accept the loss. Right now, there was nothing more she'd rather do than reach over and hold Rowan's hand again and enjoy a simple cab ride. But Rowan didn't hold hands, and his were once again encased in thick leather. She'd seen the surprise on his face back at Stewart's when he'd taken her hand without putting his glove back on first. And it had occurred to her that he was afraid to hold her hand, or anyone else's hand, for that matter. Someone had hurt him in the past, broken his trust, and he was afraid to let anyone do it again. She didn't know how she knew that truth. Either it was her ability assisting her, or women's intuition, or both. Whatever the reason, Rowan's gloves were back on, and she wasn't sure when they were coming off again. She tried to distract herself by looking out the window at the city as they headed to the station. When she thought of London, she hadn't expected to see all the canals or boats in the water. The atmospheric waterways looked like havens tucked within the city, surrounded by Victorian warehouses and charming waterside restaurants. When they reached Paddington Station, they had some time before their train, so Mellicent asked to go to Platform 1 to see the Paddington Bear statue. She couldn't pass through Paddington Station without seeing it. As a child, she'd sat on her mother's lap reading about the little bear from Darkest Peru. Seeing the life-size statue of Paddington sitting on his suitcase gave her the impulse to touch the sculpture. Perhaps she could sense an imprint from the artist who had made it, or even the author, Michael Bond. The writer must have come to see this work of art inspired by his stories. The bronze statue would be the first object she'd intentionally tried to read since the toy horse and the peace pipe. Paddington Bear seemed like a good place to start.
"You don't want to touch that," Rowan warned her,
breaking her concentration. Mellicent turned to him, her hand in midair. "Why, is there a negative imprint in it?"
"No, there's a piece of gum stuck to the side of the hat."
He nodded. Mellicent leaned down to look, and sure enough, there was a sticky wad of goo right where her hand had been about to go. "Thank you," she said wryly. Perhaps the universe was trying to tell her something. Rowan gave her a smile that didn't quite reach his eyes. His attention was now fixed on something else. Mellicent turned to see what he was looking at and caught sight of the little girl, no more than 5 years old. She was standing alone like a scared animal afraid to cross the road, as tears streamed down her face. The little girl was lost. Rowan was already walking toward her with purposeful strides, taking off his right glove as he approached. Mellicent hurried to follow. Rowan bent down on one knee to match the little girl's height.
Hello. Have you been looking at Paddington? I was just showing him to my friend here.
He motioned to Mellicent behind him, who found herself nodding and smiling to alleviate the girl's fear. The little girl looked at them both through her tears.
My name's Rowan, and this is Mellicent.
Rowan held out his bare hand for a proper handshake, and the little girl shook it.
We're visiting from out of town. Do you know the story of Paddington?
Mellicent stared at their joined hands in fascination. Rowan had his other hand by his side, tucked in some kind of mudra. The little girl nodded.
He's a very brave bear from Peru who loves honey.
Rowan continued to hold her hand.
I bet you're as brave. Do you know where your mother is?
No, and I've gone all over looking. We're visiting my auntie who just had a baby.
Would you like me to try a magic spell to find her?
He asked her. The little girl nodded vigorously. He said,
All you have to do is count to 10 and picture your mother in your mind. Can you do that?
Rowan continued to hold her hand while the girl counted. Mellicent had no idea what he was doing.
Did it work?
The little girl asked when she was finished.
Absolutely.
He took out a pen and notepad from his bag and began to write. He tore off the piece of paper and handed it to her.
Take this paper over to the policeman at the end of the platform. See him over there?
Rowan pointed out the man in uniform.
Show him the paper and he'll call your mommy for you.
Is this really mommy's telephone number?
The girl looked at Rowan in wonder.
Are you from Hogwarts?
Something like that.
He winked at her.
Now hurry on. I'm sure your mother's worried.
Without saying goodbye, the little girl took off running through the throng of people to the policeman at the end of the platform. Rowan stood up and put his glove back on and waited until she handed the note to the officer. When the officer took the paper and began to call the number, Rowan turned away.
Let's go.
He walked in the opposite direction and disappeared into the crowd. Mellicent hesitated, riveted by the sight of the little girl taking the officer's phone. The expression on the girl's face transformed from one of fear into a portrait of light when she heard her mother's voice. Mellicent felt a pang in her heart, as if it had been broken and then repaired at the same time. Rowan had helped the little girl find her way home. Mellicent didn't say a word for most of the hour-long train ride to Oxford. She stared out the window as the train sped through suburban London and left the industrial sprawl for a picturesque English countryside. The depth of Rowan's ability was beginning to boggle her mind. He had scanned that little girl like a hard drive, expertly extracting the precise information he'd needed. How had he retrieved the mother's phone number? Had he replayed a memory of the girl hearing or seeing it? And what was the mudra that he had made with his left hand? She noticed Rowan read imprints with his right hand, too, which meant he was left-handed. Maybe her ability would have been more developed by now if she had not suffered a lifetime of second-guessing which hand to use. Would she ever be able to perform such a feat? If Rowan thought her silence unusual, he gave no indication. Or perhaps he understood. He had his eyes closed, his arms were folded with one hand on his face and two fingers against his forehead, casting shadows on the frown on his face. His gloves were back on. Mellicent used the time to study him while he napped. His large frame barely fit in the space. This was a man who had been reading imprints since he was a small child, peering into the nooks and crannies of the past. If he held her hand, could he go back and see her life? Press rewind and return to any time? Was her biological body just a sum of information, a walking accumulation of every moment she had ever experienced, collected and encoded? Is that all DNA was? Rowan opened his eyes and caught her gaze. They looked at each other for a suspended moment.
"What are you thinking about?"
he asked. "You?" She watched his eyes widen in surprise. They were sitting together like any other couple on a train, a hand's touch away, an inch from a kiss. She wanted to know about his life. "When did you realize you had your ability?"
"When I was 5.
Her eyebrows rose. That was young. How did it happen?
My parents and I were on a family vacation to Disneyland, and we stopped at an outdoor flea market. My mom was rummaging through boxes of books, and my dad was browsing a stall of musical instruments.
He got a faraway smile on his face as he remembered.
I tugged on his pant leg and asked him who Roy Rogers was.
A surprised laugh escaped her. Rowan caught her eyes.
My father laughed, too. He said, "The king of the cowboys a long time ago."
Rowan extended his hand, showing her.
I had my hand around the neck of a guitar that was propped up on a stand, and I told him Roy Rogers' name was really Leonard Sly. This was his guitar before he was famous.
Millicent was hanging on to every word. How she would have loved to see Rowan at age 5 reading the imprint of Roy Rogers' guitar.
My father knelt down and asked, "How did I know?" And I said, "Because of the story in the guitar."
Rowan met Millicent's eyes.
My dad asked me to tell him the story. So I told him how Leonard had moved from Ohio to live with his sister, Mary. He was shy, but he tried out for a radio show. I knew all these things up until the time he was playing for the Rocky Mountaineers, the years before he became famous and changed his name.
What did your dad think?
He was so flustered.
Rowan chuckled.
He bought the guitar for $40. Then we went and found my mom. I told her too, in the car. They didn't know what to think. My dad read a biography on Roy Rogers and confirmed all the things I knew about Leonard Sly in the 1920s and 30s. When we got back home to New Orleans, he found a guitar salesman who restored historic guitars. The restorer found L. Sly had been written on the back of the neck and then polished off. A collector bought it from us for $10,000.
Wow. So that was the beginning of West Inc., Roy Rogers.
Roy Rogers.
Rowan nodded.
My dad had been a struggling accountant up till then. He began taking me to antique fairs to see if what had happened with the guitar was a fluke. It wasn't. After that, my parents rearranged their lives around my gift.
Now Millicent was about to meet one of those parents. Anticipation trilled through her. When they arrived at Oxford Rail Station, Millicent stepped onto the street and looked around in wonder, never once having imagined she would be in Oxford, England. The first thing she noticed was the sea of bicycles parked by the station. Rowan guided her by the elbow past the taxis.
The house is close, just a half mile near the university.
They walked toward the city center. With each step, the architecture began to transport her to centuries past, the curvature of the stones offering up a glimpse of their yesteryears. She found herself yearning to create a snow globe to capture the magic in the air.
They call it the City of Dreaming Spires, Rowan said. The university was founded in the 11th century. It's the oldest English-speaking university in the world. Some of the greatest minds have come here to study. Stephen Hawking, Indira Gandhi, Tolkien, Margaret Thatcher, Aung San Suu Kyi, Edwin Hubble.
A little smile hovered on his lips with Hubble's name.
These buildings witnessed it all,
Mellicent followed one step behind Rowan, watching him stride down the street. He seemed energized by being in Oxford and knew his way around. In fact, he looked at home. She asked him, "What does your mom teach?"
"Cultural history."
She fell into step beside him. "The history of cultures?"
"Not exactly. It's